To another episode of Vertical Momentum. I am your host, Richard Kaufman, also known as The Comeback Coach. Guys, this is going to be an amazing episode. I can feel it in my body and my spirit already. We're going to be talking about some things that are very near and dear to my heart. Mental health. We're going to be talking about spirituality. We're also going to be talking about sports. I'm a big sports geek. So guys, if you love all those things, you definitely need to listen to this gentleman we're going to be talking to next. Amazing author, two-time TEDx speaker, pastor, which I really love because I love my brothers in Christ. So I think it's going to be a great episode. Daryl, welcome to the show, my friend.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, it's my honor. And today has been Daryl Stinson Day. I've listened to, I think, almost every podcast you've ever been on. So I wanted to get to you. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing awesome, man. What was your favorite podcast that I've been on?
I just finished listening to it, not even like 7 minutes ago. It was, I can't remember now. It was about, it was a sports podcast that you were on. And the thing that touched me so much, and it made me cry, actually. So I am a big wussy about how your grandma was always praying for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And that just broke me down. So if I'm talking to you, I got a tear in my eye as we're talking. So, brother, I just want to say thank you for coming on. So what's new in your world? And then we're going to hop into the Wayback Machine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, man, what is new in my world? I think that, you know, just elevating the voices of others. I set a goal 3 months ago to impact 1 million people in 12 months. And I wanted to do that in part by empowering other speakers to get out there and share their story, because I recognize that our perspectives are unique, and it helps when we have voices who have followed similar journeys than I have. And so, you know, while I love to be a speaker and I love to talk about mental health and my journey as an athlete and all the things that I'm passionate about, other people are passionate about other things, and they're waiting for voices to step up, overcome that fear of public speaking, own that stage, and share their story, make an impact, and that only they can make. So that's been my focus, is speaking and empowering other speakers. And then, of course, just always staying grounded in what matters the most, my faith, my family, my community.
And you got, I don't know how you able to ever get into the bathroom having all those girls in that house, but.
I've got this outhouse out back, you know, they send me back there.
Yeah, because I got one girl and I could hardly take it. So I can imagine how having, you know, all your princesses in your house.
Oh yeah. My closet space is like the downstairs where the people put their coats. You know, that's where I get closet space, you know? So yeah. It's fun living with women, man.
So we're going to go back now. My personal thought is I'm going to ask you a lot of questions that you're probably not used to getting asked, because I'm the male Oprah. So I just want to let you know that, even though you're not going to win a free car. And so I want to go back and I want to go way back to where you're from and talk to us about little Daryl and how he was as a little child.
Mm. You want to talk about little Daryl. What would you like to know about little Daryl?
How were you? What was it like growing up and just getting into your mindset, you know, as a young child? Were you a child that liked to read? Were you a child that liked to be active?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The thing I like about speaking, and especially when I speak to the same audience year after year, or in some cases, I've even done it as much as once every week, and it forces you to review your life in a new way. And I think one of the relevant stories of my childhood that relates to so many people is I remember two vivid instances in my childhood. One is, you know, I grew up just a curious kid. I was smart. I always did my homework. Like, I would do it before I did anything else. I was extremely disciplined. School was easy. School was fun until school was not, you know. And, you know, I always tell the story that I told in my TEDx talk, that And my mother put me in accelerated learning classes when I was in the third grade because she noticed how smart, how charismatic I was. And I passed some tests that showed that, you know, I had high IQ. And so I was in this accelerated learning class and I was probably the smartest kid in my class, which is a pretty heavy statement considering some of the people that have come out of that class and looking at what they're doing with their lives today is just so amazing. But I'm from Jackson, Michigan, and me being in an accelerated learning class, what that meant that I was one of two Black students in an all-white class. And there was nothing wrong with this. It actually worked in my favor. I stood out. People cheated off my test. They laughed at my jokes. They nicknamed me Goon because I was this big, goony, like goofy looking guy. And I was living my best life. And one day I was coming back from the bathroom break and I noticed a group of Black students circled together laughing hysterically in the hallway. And I was just like, hey, let me go in here, make some jokes and see what's so funny. So I walk over to them and I'm just like, hey, yo, what's so funny? No one answers. And I'm like, I know they hear me, you know? And so I spoke up. I'm like, what y'all over there laughing about? And I couldn't even finish my sentence before one of the students turned towards me and said, your was funny, white boy. And the crowd just cracked up, man. And I had no clue what that meant. And I walked away feeling ashamed and rejected. And what I say to people is that was the moment that I believed the dangerous lie that who I was authentically wasn't enough to be liked or loved by other people. And what I know now that I didn't know then is that rejection has a way of making us feel like we're not good enough. I mean, something as simple as, you know, people who want to go out for drinks and to have dinner after work and you're not invited. And now you take that moment of rejection and go, well, what's so wrong with me? What's wrong with the way that I talk? What's wrong with my dress? What's wrong with my performance? Like, obviously, something has to be wrong with me since I'm not fitting in with this group. And it changes for everyone. But rejection has us question our identity. And that's what I did. And, you know, that, you know, led to me starting to question, you know, if I should talk the way that I talked, if I should have the habits that I had, even though they were serving me at the time, they weren't serving me socially with this group of students. And so I just started slowly but surely kind of making, you know, compromises in certain areas to fit in with other people. So, you know, if they were playing an extra round of ball after school, I would kind of skip out on that and I would go hang out and run the streets and you know, steal bikes or something, just doing dumb stuff because that's what these other groups of friends were doing. And ultimately, man, that led me down a road to where I made a lot of changes about my identity to fit in with the Black community. So let me stop there and just see what other questions you may have.
No, because I'm very interested because when I grew up, and obviously I'm an old white dude now, but I went to one of the high schools that I went to because I got thrown out of like five of them. I was the only white guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of understand what you're talking about, you know, but, you know, I got ingrained into the culture, you know, and eventually, you know, I don't ever see color. I don't see Black. I don't see white. Maybe that's because I was in the military for 23 years and all I see is green. You know, everybody's just a person, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I totally get where you're coming from. And for me, I kind of went on the wrong side of the tracks, you know, got messed up with drugs, alcohol, blah, blah, blah. So what was it like in high school when you finally moved up into high school, moving into puberty? You know, so what was that like going into high school?
Well, high school was completely different because I had a complete transformation in terms of who I was. So whereas the third grader, I was kind of like this goody two shoes kid. And that moment happened and I started to kind of, you know, make poor decisions. And in about the seventh grade, my cousin's mother, my auntie Stephanie, got shot and killed in broad daylight. And that caused him to move in with us because his father was in prison. And he brought in a whole nother group of friends that were making terrible decisions, skipping, you know, at the seventh grade, they were skipping school. They were selling drugs. They were trying to have sex and, you know, without protection and just do all these things. And lots of fights and violence. And, you know, that was who was around me every day since my cousin came and moved in with me. So I started to be like them and rap and skip school and get in fights. I actually got suspended from seventh grade 10 times, which which should have got me expelled from the public school system. But it was just one of those things where the principal there gave me one more chance and allowed me to have that last suspension as in-school suspension. So by the time I got to the high school, you know, it was full-blown street personality person. You know, like I was, you know, I was probably still getting, you know, C's and B's because I was just smart to like know how to pass tests, but I was not applying myself. I think I skipped one of my classes for an entire year, never ever, you know, finished it and completed that class. I mean, there's so many things that, you know, I used to go to school, you know, high off drugs and all while being a star athlete. So I'm playing sports all the time, man. I mean, like summer, I played three sports like freshman year and then two sports sophomore year. And then, you know, two sports for the rest of, you know, my career, which was basketball and football. And I played them both all year round competitively. And so, you know, it was always, you know, another game, another, you know, media interview. Cause probably when I hit sophomore year, I had a breakout year for my season because I was a sophomore who was leading our varsity in scoring. And then I played on a really good AAU basketball team that got me some international or national attention, excuse me. And after that, it was kind of a wrap. I was on everyone's radar for basketball. And I was still doing numbers in football. And so, college was just, that's what it was. It was the party. It was the drug dealer / star athlete lifestyle. And I was a typical jockey with the big head ego, you know, and earned a full ride scholarship to go to Central Michigan University.
Now, do you think, because, you know, I've talked to a lot of professional athletes. And I've met a lot of professional athletes and, you know, I used to train guys from WWE, NFL and Major League Baseball, NBA. And some of them got pushed through high school and through college years just because they were, you know, a three-star, four-star. But when you talk to them, they couldn't put a sentence together. So do you see that as a problem of, or do you see things starting to get better with that?
No, that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem because a lot of times the reason why the athletes are some of those type of athletes are so good is because they usually come from rough backgrounds and they've got a chip on their shoulder and something to prove. And it's their only hope. And so they're focused solely on the sport and academics, although they say it's student first and athlete. It's not the reality. It's athlete first and student. So the academics just become a standard where you really just want to maintain eligibility versus to stretch yourself to your full potential academically. And I think a lot of it is on the culture. I think there's a lot of things administration can do. I think there's a lot of things that the athlete themselves can do. But I think a big majority of it is just like the sheer time that it takes at the collegiate level to succeed at sports and get ahead. It just takes too much time commitment that you don't have any more energy to excel academically. Not saying it can't be done, not saying that it's not possible, just saying that I think that there's changes that we can make to be able to make it a little bit easier for students. And that's, you know, a lot of people don't understand, like there's this red shirt thing that you can do and gray shirt in college athletics. Red shirt meaning that you cannot actively play your freshman year at college, and that they will, you know, not count that against your year of eligibility. So you'd still get four more years of scholarship to play. That's extremely important for the academic success of a student athlete, because now they have an extra year if they so choose to stretch out a four-year degree. And that's so important. So now when I'm playing during season, I can take as least amount of credits as possible because I'm traveling, I'm playing, I'm sore, I'm catching up. And that way when I'm off season, that I can pick up the credits a little bit and then do some throughout the summer. And if we sprinkle it out that way, I think it enables the student athlete to have some better success academically.
Okay. So I have a question because Like I said, first of all, I just want to thank you for taking the time to hang out with us today.
My pleasure.
Appreciated. But what are your thoughts now? Because I know the NCAA are paying athletes now. And the funny thing is, my son
are they paying athletes?
Yep, they're starting to. I think it's this year or the end of next year.
Man, but show me the check.
Yeah, my son goes to Coastal Carolina, and our football team is doing really well. But it's just, I don't see, you know, maybe because I'm seeing it from the outside, you know, I just don't see athletes getting paid from the NCAA, you know, from colleges. What are your thoughts on that?
I am not in a position to have
something
that I would say is good enough for Marks to give an answer. I can say that I think we're headed in the right direction. I think it's going to be messy. I don't know if the current terms of agreements are in everyone's best favor, but it's a good step to explore and test the waters a little bit.
Cool.
The only thing I would say is recognize that it's in my opinion, we should consider more so than the dollar amounts that are involved, that we take into consideration the emotional and mental maturity of our student athletes. That's it.
You know, and I love it. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up, because there's a kid, he plays center for the Coastal, and this kid weighs every bit of 380 pounds. So I know, you know, just to eat three times a day, got to be starving. And I'm sure it costs a lot, especially like for me, you know, I was in the health and fitness industry and the supplement industry. It's got to be very expensive to eat and for supplementation just to stay healthy, correct?
Oh my gosh, it's so much. Yeah. And every position's different. You know, I came in and I needed to gain that amount of weight. Like, I think at one point I was trying to gain a pound a week, and that is expensive. But there are some people who come in, they need to lose weight, you know, so they don't actually have that expense. But either way, I don't think the conversation is to compensate athletes so that they can afford basic needs. I think the conversation is to compensate athletes because they make the university a ton of money. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. they need part of that share, you know, and it makes sense. It really does. But I think that how we do it is important. And I know that the current legislation has taken that into consideration from what I've heard. But I think that there's this emotional and mental maturity level that a student athlete needs to be at before we give them too much too soon. And how much is too much too soon? I don't know. I don't have a way to measure that accurately. I just know somebody smarter than me should take that into consideration.
I got it.
Yeah.
So high school, what position did you play? And when you got to go play college football, what position did you go play?
Yeah, I played defensive end in my senior year in high school. But all throughout high school, I was a quarterback, running back, wide receiver, special teams kicker. I played every position just because I was athletic enough to do so, and it was fun. And I know, I think to this day, one of my greatest regrets might have been not going to quarterback school or something, because I think like a quarterback. I don't think like a defensive end, and I think I would have been a much better quarterback than I was a defensive end, and I was a really good defensive end. But yeah, so that, and then for basketball, I played like power forward and center at my college. But when I was on the road, I played shooting guard and small forward because I was playing with people who were much, much taller than I was. So, yeah, that was, and when in college, I kept the DN position. They moved me to O-line for like 2 weeks, and then they were like, nah, this isn't going to work out. So they moved me back to DN. and it was much better for me.
Well, they say if you ever want to get rich, learn how to play left tackle. There's a lot of money to be made in the NFL with a left tackle.
Yeah, if you want to be rich and have a rewarding career, that might be a good idea. Or be a quarterback would be a better idea.
So now, what happened to you? Why, you know, did you not, you know, continue on with your career? You had a devastating injury, correct?
Yeah. So I played my freshman year, very little, but I played, towards the end of my freshman year, I started to have some lower back problems, and they just, you know, they allowed me to travel, but I was still lifting with the people who didn't travel. Excuse me for a second. So yeah, they allowed me to travel. And towards the end of my freshman year, I was squatting and trying to show the upperclassmen how much I could lift, you know, impress everybody. And I came up the wrong way, and I knew that I did something wrong, but I didn't know what it was. And it was just in pain. I thought maybe I just like overstretched the ligament or something. And I got it checked out. And, you know, I didn't know the difference between being hurt and being injured. So I thought that I was hurt, but I really was injured. So I thought that I just had to stretch the ligament. I just needed to ice it. And so I practiced with it for probably about 2.5-3 months. And, not knowing that I was on a pinched nerve. And so finally it just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse till finally, I mean, I couldn't even sleep through the night. So I get up and I go and I finally get, you know, an MRI, and I have to have emergency back surgery because my left leg is getting ready to go paralyzed because of how long the pinched nerve in my back had been deteriorating my left leg muscle. And so, you know, I think I got my MRI results on a Friday. The doctor came in on like a Sunday and did my surgery. It was so crazy. He was booked for 6 months. So that's how serious of an issue it was. And I get this surgery, and it should be game over. Like it's a double laminectomy surgery. It was relatively simple. They cut me open. They removed several portions of the bones that were pinching the nerves, and then they shifted it to the left a little bit, and then they sewed me up and called it a day. And that's a pretty serious back surgery because it's a spinal injury and it takes a long time to heal. And the way that I, you know, the coaches were like, we'll still honor your scholarship. You can come around football whenever you want. So you've got this golden ticket to focus on your education and still have all the fun in the world being a part of the football team. But that wasn't enough for me. I wanted to be in. And so I begged them to allow me to come back from the game and play. And so I always tell people the story this way. It's like I wasn't supposed to walk more than a mile within 6 months after my surgery. But I ended up earning a starting position within 6 months. So I did not heal correctly. I was using opioids to numb the pain to come back and play the game of football. And I knew that I would need more opioids than what they were prescribing me to. So I found a way to manipulate the healthcare system and go to different doctor's offices to get more and more prescription medication. All those doctor visits cost money. Those co-pays, all that stuff that I had to pay cost money. And so I started to sell drugs even more to cover the cost of my healthcare expenses. And, you know, for 2 years, you know, I was living a double life. On the outside, I was this in the daylight, I would say, as I was this charismatic, you know, starting defensive lineman for, you know, the Chippewas, who is a good guy and a class A citizen. And behind the scenes, I was a drug dealer, you know, selling drugs all throughout the state of Michigan. And, developing a drug addiction to the opioids I was taking. And that was my life for 2 years until it came to a crashing halt my senior year.
You know, by the way, you're really touching my heart because I am a recovering addict. I've got 33 years clean January. Awesome. It really touches me. And a lot of people don't realize that over 73,000 people every year die of opioid.
Mm-hmm.
Overdoses.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I'm guessing, you know, when you first started, nobody ever plans on becoming an addict.
Not at and all.
Then when you have to, you know, they say get, like they always say, you know, get high on your own supply. And you have to start doing it just so you don't get dope sick. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, at that point it's just surviving. It's not even feeling better. Now you're just taking the opioids just so you're not throwing up and puking. You know what I mean?
Man, the opioid conversation is such a large one because it's similar to the mental health conversation that I'm often a part of. It's such a varying degree of addiction that people just have such a negative stigma around an addict. And not that being an addict is a good thing, but that not every person who's an addict is like shoving needles in their arm, hiding underneath the bridge, can't control themselves, you know, slobbering and one dirty needle away from the end of their life. That's not everyone's reality. There's spectrums to it, and there's things called functioning alcoholics. There are people who are sex addicts, and like, so it's just a variety. And I know because I do a significant amount of work here in Metro Atlanta in the addiction recovery space, so I'm very familiar with the territory and the nuances. The thing I would just say is, of course, be careful of allowing, you know, something that could, you know, taking advantage of the healthcare system. You know, they're expecting that if they give you a 30-day supply, that you're going to use this 30-day supply. But a lot of people, you know, will not use it, and then they'll double up and they'll get a refill, and they'll just get a couple of refills, and now they're stacked, and now they're popping two or three, and they're 3 months ahead. So, you know, they never get discovered. And then now they, when they finally catch up to the monthly prescription, then they're like, "Whoa, wait, I can't keep taking this amount because I only get a 30-day refill every time. So now where do I get more?" Yeah. And then it becomes a whole drug deal, you know? And so we just got to watch out for these warning signs and make sure that we're building quality relationships with people, checking in on people we care about. I'm telling you right now, you'd be surprised about the number of people who have mental health issues or addiction issues who you would never know. They might be your favorite hero. You know, the story that comes to mind is Robin Williams. You know, I use him often in my talk. Like, think about that. Like, that's just his whole story in public. I never forget. Why, I don't know if you followed his journey much, but if you watch his interview, there's an interview with him, and they're asking him how he got started in comedy. And he starts talking about how he used comedy to get his mother's attention because they were always too busy. Mm-hmm. And that's how, and so the interviewer is like fascinated that this kid has developed this gift of comedy as a skill and has been doing it since a childhood. And I'm like, you're missing the warning sign.
Yeah.
Like, his whole life is built on the fact that he didn't get love from the person he was supposed to get the most love from.
Yeah.
and nobody stopped the interview and said, whoa, how does that make you feel? You know, instead we're like, whoa, that's why you're a great actor. And I'm like, no, talk about the downside of that. And sure enough, you know, ultimately, you know, and yeah, they said he had some mental illness going on. And I'm not denying that his brain was shutting down or anything, but still he ultimately made the decision to end his own life. And I think part of it is because we get used to seeing people's gifts instead of seeing the person that's behind the gift.
Yep. And unfortunately, a lot of actors have a very high suicide rate and a very high addiction rate. But now, question, now I want you to take us into, because I had my own suicide attempt on Memorial Day of 2012. And thank God it didn't go through. He saved me. Talk to us about when your life came crashing down.
Yeah. So, you know, going into my senior, so my junior year was a wreck. You know, I was missing a lot of practices because I kept having these frequent nosebleeds, and I was blaming them on allergies. And I think early on in that year, that preseason game, we had this game against Michigan State, which was a really, really big game, obviously. And I was kicking, they had Kirk Cousins, and we obviously had our players too, but I came out the gate blazing. I mean, I got a couple of QB rushes on Kurt, and they were like, yeah, since it's supposed to dominate this whole game, we're going to beat Michigan State again. You know, we just had beat them 2 years earlier. And my nose has started bleeding, and I was not the same after the first quarter and that nosebleed, and it did not recover. My nose was bleeding because I was taking so many opioids that they were thinning my blood, that every time I would, you know, get going on the field too much or make contact, that my nose would bleed. And then I would have to play the remainder of the game with nose plugs in my nose, or if I was at practice with nose plugs. And coaches kind of, you know, that was their big sign of like, this shouldn't be happening. You know, it was a nice day. There's no reason why this kid should be having allergies. And so they started to catch up. And then I started to develop this permanent hunch in my back because, you know, I was just, my back was tired of taking a beating. And so they noticed, like, man, he can't stand up straight. He's not running the same. He's lost a step in his speed. He's not stretching out. He's having frequent nosebleeds. Man, we think this guy's out. You know, like he's hiding some stuff from us. And they were right. I was. And so they called me out on it, and I denied it, of course. But eventually they just said, hey, we just want to let you know we can't let you continue anymore. And I don't even know what they were trying to say after that. That's all I heard. And I got mad. I think I knocked some stuff off, and I cussed them out, man. I was pissed because I feel like they quit on me. I feel like they quit on my dream. I feel like there was so much more they could have did to support my rehabilitation, but they didn't. And I was angry and I left, and I was mad at the world. And I was trapped because I had a decision to make. Was I going to devote my time, my energy, my effort towards another career path that I wasn't passionate about? Or was I going to just be a drug dealer for the rest of my life? And I didn't like any of those narratives. I didn't think that anything in life would fulfill me as much as sports did. I didn't even know who I truly was without that identity as an athlete, because I had changed everything about myself since the third grade, and then more dramatically in the seventh grade when my cousin came and moved in with me. And so I was like, I don't even know who Daryl is. I don't know what my real laugh is, what the actual music I like. I'm so confused. I can't unexplain it. I was so lost. And I started to feel like, man, nobody really cares about me since I'm not an athlete. And the coaches weren't calling and checking in on me anymore. My players were finishing out their season and, you know, making national television plays, and they weren't checking in on me anymore. People on campus weren't hitting me up. My phone wasn't ringing for post-game interviews. I wasn't actively trying to sell drugs. So my phone went from ringing all the time and being busy all the time to doing nothing. And I started to have these battles with depression. Like, why am I here? Nobody really cares about me. I bet you if I was gone, they wouldn't notice that I wasn't here any longer. And I was confiding in one person during this time, which was my girlfriend, who was my high school sweetheart. She and I had been dating since high school, and she followed me to Central Michigan, and I would tell her every time I feel depressed. And one day when I reached out to her in the middle of I call it a minor suicide attempt, but I don't think that there's anything such as minor, you know, but, you know, I was trying to, you know, take overdose on pills, and I reached out to her to just come help me and talk to me and be with me, and she wouldn't. And I soon learned that it was because she had left me and got engaged to another man because I was no longer going to the NFL. And that was it for me. She left. I didn't have that stability. I wasn't going to come out and talk to anybody else about it because I was embarrassed. And I just caved and I imploded. And the attempts got more serious. I started drinking whole fifths of alcohol, getting in a car, hoping that a car accident would end it all. I would look up how to commit suicide and research all these ways. I remember one time swallowing a whole bottle of oxycodone and hoping that I wouldn't wake up the next morning. And one day I sat in this blue Dodge Stratus and made my final attempt. And I wrote my suicide letter, and I turned my phone on silent. And I had planned to drive 75 miles per hour onto oncoming traffic off of a highway. And I went to go do that. And I started raving 75 miles per hour down a 35 mile per hour road. And I'm crying, and I've got tears in my eye, and I have my music cranked up. and out of the corner of my eye, I see my cell phone blinking. And I look at it, and it's my mother calling me, and I go to hit the end button. But because I was still driving, I wasn't like paying attention all the way, and I was obviously on drugs. So I accidentally hit the answer button. And my mother, oh God, sorry.
No, that's this is what it's all about. I mean, you know, sometimes you go on podcasts and it's all fluff. This is real. You know, this is real stuff between two brothers that have gone through this. And the funny thing is, you're talking about this, and that was exactly how I attempted my suicide. And thank God it didn't go through. So please go ahead, because the Lord used your mom to save your butt.
Yeah. So my mother, and the first words that come out of her mouth was just like, Daryl. And I'm shocked, because I'm like, what? You know, she's like, I don't know what's going on right now, but I need you to come let me help you. Like, I don't know what's going on, but I just feel like I should call you. And I knew she was right. And she probably could hear the tears and hear my voice when I had answered and said what. And so she convinced me to drive from Mount Pleasant, Michigan, where I was making my final attempt, to Detroit, Michigan. And I get there, and she's trying to ask me questions, and I don't want to talk. And she sees how sick I look. I'm 219 pounds when I was just 275 pounds 4 weeks before. And so she knows that I'm like not doing well, and she just tries to get me to eat something, and I managed to get down some tomato soup. She goes and lays down, and then I lay down and try to get some sleep. And when I tried to sleep, my mind was just racing and racing and racing and racing, and it wouldn't stop racing, and I couldn't stop it from racing. So I just got up and said, I'm just going to finish what I started. And so I left out the house, and I get in the car. And I guess that when I left, I forgot to like make sure the screen door didn't slam. So the screen door had slammed. That woke up my mother. And by the time I started the car, my mother was coming through the front door, and she just jumped on my car and was like, let me get you help. And so she takes me to the psychiatric care facility in Detroit, Michigan. And the way that I always describe this part of the story is that I go into the psychiatric care facility, and the doctor comes in. He starts asking me questions like, why did you want to, you know, kill yourself, and what was going on? And I just kept screaming at him, leave me alone. I just want to die. A few moments later, he leaves. He goes to finish some paperwork so they can admit me upstairs to the care facility. And a nurse walks in. I call her the woman with green pants. And I call her this because at this point, my eyes were swollen, basically shut. And all I could see is just a little slit to see that she had on green pants. And she comes in and she wraps me in her arms. And she says, baby, I've been praying for you all the way here. God told me, you know exactly what to do. You need to say yes to him. Now, keep in mind, I was not a person of faith at this time. I was actually agnostic. I actually hated organized religion of any kind. And I was really into a lot of secret societies and stuff like this. Not personally involved, but that's what I believe like runs the world. And so whatever faith she was trying to present to me, I didn't want any of that. I was like, leave me alone. I just want to die. And I just like kept screaming that over and over again. And this woman prayed for me, my mother said, for like 10, 15 minutes. It felt like 3 minutes for me, because I just kept screaming the whole time, just leave me alone. I just want to die. She left. She said she would come back. And a few moments later, my grandmother burst through the room. She had driven from Jackson to Detroit, which is about an hour and a half. She had driven once my mom told her I was in there, and she had ran through the hospital. She burst through the door, and she's out of breath, and she wraps me in her arms, and she's like, honey, I've been praying for you all the way here. God told me, you know exactly what to do. You need to say yes to him. So it was the same request two different times from two people who didn't know each other and never crossed paths. And I couldn't deny that it was God's way of trying to speak to me through people. But my heart was still so hard, and I had so many doubts. And my grandmother was a religious person, so she was supposed to say something religious. And I didn't understand how saying yes to God was going to heal my back, bring my girlfriend back, get my career back. And so I just kept saying, "That's your God. Leave me alone. I just want to die." My grandmother prayed for me for about 5 minutes. She backs away, and the best way I know how to describe it is that in the room, it felt like there was heavy blankets weighing on top of all of us. It was so depressing in there. Everyone's thinking the same question is, how did we let Daryl get here? And in the middle of that pain and that darkness and that frustration, I just heard this still small inner voice say, "Daryl, will you say yes to me?" It's what I would now call the voice of God. And the moment that I heard my father's voice, it was something about it that gave me the strength to mutter out a yes. And the moment that I said yes, I promise you, it felt so good. The depression that I was under immediately left. My eyes actually got healed. I could open them. I could see again. I didn't know what to do. I just kept screaming, "Yes, Lord, yes, Lord, yes, Lord." The doctor runs in the room because he hears me yelling, "Yes, Lord." And he goes, "Wait, yo, what's going on? What's going on?" And I was like, "I was running from God and I just said yes to him." And he goes, "Let's hurry up and get this guy upstairs."
Nice.
This is a true story. That was the moment my life changed. That was the moment that I got hope. Now, I stayed in the psychiatric unit and I did some inner healing. But I came out completely transformed, a man of faith on fire to find out what my purpose was beyond sports.
Now, okay, so, you know, I always thought that, you know, I was a Billy Badass, you know, working with all these athletes and running a $1 million general nutrition center. And then, you know, they say that, you know, God will humble you. He'll get your attention one way or another. And it just happened that I had an accident and now I'm 80% blind. But that's when I had to realize and humble myself and say, "You know what, Lord, you're in charge. You know, I'm just here. You direct my steps." So talk to us a little bit about, you know, having to become humble. And you know, a lot of people think that, you know, being meek is weakness, but actually in the Bible that it says, you know, weakness is actually power under control. And so when you humble yourself and become a follower, it seems like life gets better and he knows what's best for you, but sometimes he has to humble you in order to get your attention. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question, by the way. So thank you for asking that. And, you know, the whole humility conversation is, I usually just say, like, you got to be in pursuit of humility, or always make sure you have relationships who can monitor your humility. Cause the moment you think you have it, you've lost it. The moment I say I'm humble, I've ceased to be humble, you know? But I get your point is that you do have to embrace this process of what God's calling you to do and who he's calling you to be with humility and sensitivity and nimbleness of heart. So I wholeheartedly understand what you're saying. And I love the question. For me, that came from a belief that there's something in life more fulfilling than sports. Like there has to be. God would not have let me survive that low moment if he didn't have something better for me. And so I think first was, and this is kind of ultimately where I eventually came up with my 5-step transition roadmap that I mentioned in my book. And I walked people through those 5 steps. And it was what God had walked me through in order to get to a place of wholeness and happiness and fulfillment. And so the first thing is accept. That's the first, you know, phase of transition in my athlete's transition roadmap, is that you have to let the past go. Right. You can't drive forward while looking through the rearview mirror. And it was the same way for me. I had to stop rehearsing this narrative of like my best days are behind me and that my glory days are when I was an athlete. And I had to truly let that go and stop talking about how good I should have, could have, would have been, and realize that I never was. And that was a hard pill to swallow. for me, and it is for a lot of athletes. You hear them, you talk about their sports career, and their 40 time keeps getting faster, their bench press keeps getting stronger, because they're still stuck in the past and they're trying to prove to you how good they could have been versus accept how good they actually became. And so I had to really get over that and close that chapter. And then I had to start believing in a brighter future. I had to work on my mindset. I had to make sure I was doing declarations and affirmations. I had to make sure that even when I felt like I couldn't find something that was right for my skill set, or a job wasn't opening up, or I felt unfulfilled in my career, that my best days are still ahead of me. I'm learning right now. I'm making career investments right now, but my best days are still ahead of me. And I had to maintain that mentality lest I quit or go backwards or throw in the towel. And once I got to that, I had to figure out what my purpose actually was. So I accepted that the past was the past. I started to believe that there was a brighter future. And then I had to actually discover what that bright future was. And this is what people love to start. It's like, what do I do next? How do I find my purpose, my passion? It took me about 5 years to find it. I studied every major world religion. Yes, even though I was a Christian, I studied every major world religion. I read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, Simon Sinek's Why, Rick Warren's Purpose-Driven Life, several others on purpose, meaning, and identity. And I started to find different things, different questions to ask myself to unlock a new layer of thought and of my being. And I got to this point where I figured out my purpose. And I just began this process of investing in myself, asking mentors for what they saw in me, diving deep into what purpose and meaning and identity were, figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. And then after I figured it out, I just had to go do it. And I had to do it afraid. And I had to do it starting over from scratch. You know, I couldn't be like, hey, I'm a great speaker because I ran fast. Like, no, like you have to be a great speaker, you know? And I wasn't. I sucked. I was terrible. And I couldn't put two sentences together. And I used to be so insecure, Richard, that when people did icebreakers, I would leave the room and fake like I had to go to the bathroom so that they wouldn't call on me. So
and now look at you.
Well, yeah, look at me, right? But this is the process, and it took years, and it took surrender and humility as you took it. And it took like not just humility from doing it and not becoming prideful, but humility just to ask somebody like, I really need help. Like I do not want to do this, but I know I'm supposed to, you know, like I know this is part of it. I know it's just my insecurity getting in my way. I know it's just my doubts getting in my way. And being humble enough to allow people to speak into your life, and being favored and fortunate enough to have people who saw the gifts in me. And I think that's important to know. It's like some people might not have that, and it's important to find it and pray for it, because that made the world of a difference to have coaches, to have pastors, to have leaders who saw in me what I was struggling to even see in me.
And, you know, one thing you said, you know, one good thing about me going blind is my hearing is excellent. And when I interview somebody, I actually hang on every word that they say. And you said something that I've been talking a lot about lately. You know, now today's days, you know, the iPhone 13 is about to come out. Somebody won't think about nothing about dropping $1,200 for a phone. But if you ask them to, you know, spend $700 on a course, they look at you like you're crazy. It's like, but you're investing in a phone, but you're not investing in yourself. You know, you're not investing, you know, in masterminds. You know, you're not investing in courses, in learning. So talk to us about investing in yourself before you start investing in things.
Yeah, it's so important. And I think this is, you'll find this interesting. I had never read like a self-help book or something like that until after, you know, I survived suicide, you know. So I was a full-blown senior in college before I ever read my first self-help book. And the reason why I read it was a combination of two things. Number one, I remember being, I can't remember what year in college I was, but I remember hearing a teacher make a joke about how she was like, if you want to hide something from a Black person, where do you hide it? And, you know, people were like, you know, the rich part of town or whatever, you know, saying all this stuff. And then she was like, no, you put it in between the pages of a book. And a few people laughed, but a lot of people didn't because it wasn't really funny. And it was very insensitive. And that moment meant something to me. And I remember thinking like, man, that's racist, you know? And then when I fast forward to my senior year, my pastor was very big on leadership, and he kept saying, you know, leaders are readers, you know, not all readers are leaders, but all leaders are readers. And I just remember him saying that over and over and over again. And finally, I was just like, he sees me as a leader. He doesn't understand I don't read. So man, I should probably read. And I picked up a book, and I'm telling you, this is going to be funny. I couldn't even read for more than 5 minutes without falling asleep. So like I would start trying to read and I would just be full blown sleep. And it didn't matter if it was the middle of the day or at night. It was boring to me, but I stuck at it. And I honestly thought it was pointless until one day I'm walking back into the office with my boss at CMU. And this was now I had graduated and I'm talking to my boss and I'm asking her a bunch of questions. And I remember we were just dialoguing and she had said something to me and I said something back to her and she was like, "Ooh, that was really good. That was an intriguing thought." And I remember thinking like, "Oh man, I read that in the book." And so that's why I really started falling in love with reading, is because I saw the benefit of it. To say something that could help my boss in her leadership when she was my boss was just like, "Ooh, knowledge is power." And so I just started devouring leadership development books and going to leadership development conferences because I started to see the reward and the payoff of it. And I would say that to people is like, as it relates to investing in yourself through self-help books, you know, you want to read stuff that's going to help you get better at what it is you're called to do. And so, and read books that give you a different perspective as well. And all that is not, it's like sowing seeds in your garden. Like it's going to produce the harvest later. And it's going to start to come out. And, you know, the old adage is you can't pour out what you haven't poured in. And so as you're creating content, as you're mentoring other people, as you're just sharing your life lessons through everyday relationships, you'll start to pull from the wisdom of the books you read and are able to help people at a higher level than you could had you not invested in yourself. You know, and so then I hit that. Let me touch on this real quick, because this is where I had to shift, you know, from books to high ticket coaching, which was a whole nother level of investment. I remember, you know, the first quote I got for a high ticket program was like $5,000. And I was like, there's no way I'm paying somebody $5,000. It's like complete manipulation, you know, is what I thought. And then I realized that, hey, it's not a, you know, I'm worth the investment. You know, if I would never look at a property that cost a lot and be like, that's a scam. I would be like, man, that's a great investment. In fact, the more that I value that property, the more I invest in it. And I realized that I was having issues with paying for $5,000 in coaching, not because it was too expensive, not even because I couldn't afford it, but because I didn't see myself as worthy of a $5,000 investment. And when I started to work on that, to look within and see, man, why am I so afraid? Why don't I believe in myself? That I had to go through some healing, and then that enabled me to start investing even more in myself. So I think it's important. I think people should say like, man, you're worth way more than a book of investment. You're worth way more than a leadership conference. You're worth way more than, you know, hiring a coach to help you move forward in life and in family. Like, you are worth the investment.
I love it. Now, talk to us about, because I've watched both of your TEDx speeches and both of them are amazing. Talk to us about that experience and what you've, how you got on the first TEDx and the second, and what your experience was like, and what it's, has it helped at all for you?
Of course, man. My first TEDx talk has more than 1 million views and counting at the date of the recording of this podcast. And I recorded it when I was still like tiptoeing around being a speaker, you know, I was still trying to play it safe, you know? And the way that I earned that opportunity was I invested in a speaker coaching program, and they had a speaking competition with all of the participants of their program. There was probably about 100 plus of us, maybe more. And, it's so funny. We had to submit a 4-minute video, and the person who had the best video in their eyes, they won a TEDx stage eventually. Like the technically what you won was to work with a coach who would then get you on a TEDx stage, but you won a TEDx stage. And so I won the event, and it's so funny because I wasn't going to participate, and it kept eating up at me. And I went and I said, I'm going to try to record my speech now. And if I don't do it in one take, then I'm not, because my family's getting ready to eat dinner. And I didn't do it. And I came in, we were sitting down getting ready to eat. We had just said grace. And my wife could just tell it was eating me up. And she looks at me and she goes, what's wrong? And then I told her, man, I don't know. I just feel scared and bummed out that, you know, that I didn't even try type of thing. She was like, well, you paid for that program, so you owe it to yourself to try. Just go out there and try one more time. And if you don't do a take, whether you like the take or not, just send it. So I did it one more time while my family was waiting for me to come eat with them. And then I just sent it and I won. And so that's how I got on that TEDx stage. And it was such an, surreal experience, because I'm a very boring person. I have two favorite movies in the whole wide world. You probably won't even know them. One is Freedom Riders, and the other is The Great Debaters. Have you seen either?
I've seen them both.
Okay, so you know that, right? So, yep. And if I had to pick an order, my first favorite movie would be The Great Debaters. Now, when you talk about favorite movies of all times, although those are good movies, I haven't met anybody who that's their favorite movie. So it kind of like,
makes me. I got one for you then.
Yeah, what's that?
Knowing that I'm a 53-year-old white guy.
Okay.
What do you think my favorite movie of all time is?
Probably something I don't know the name of. I don't know. I didn't go with the movie. I went with Happy Gilmore.
The autobiography of Malcolm X.
Oh, I would never guess that. I haven't even seen that.
And because I love it, I'm a big history buff, but also when he was in jail, they asked him, how you feel of being in jail? He says, my body may be in jail, but my mind is free.
Yeah. I heard that quote before.
And that kind of just got me going. So, a lot of people, I get a lot of people, they'll say, I can bet what kind of music you listen to. And I'm like, bro, I don't think you really know what kind I listen to. And they're like, I know who you listen to. And they make a list. And I go, do you know who Kirk Franklin is? And they're like, no. I was like, okay, I didn't think so. So they look at my phone, and I got when I was younger, I had, I still have on my phone when I'm working out, Tupac, Biggie, Too Short, stuff like that. And they're like, wait a minute, you're a 53-year-old white guy.
So, yeah, that's hilarious, man. So I would have never guessed that.
So now, because obviously it's been seen a million times,
yeah,
and it gives you authority a little bit, when you put it on your pages, that you're a TEDx speaker. But isn't it amazing that you're affecting that many people? You're dropping that many little nuggets to these people,
Yeah, I want to say something there, because I actually do help people with getting on the TEDx stage, and I actually host two TEDx events here with the help of a team in Metro Atlanta. And I love TEDx platform, and I know it's something that can dramatically change a person's career, but more so it can change our world. And I really believe in that, because TEDx is about ideas worth spreading. And so for me, it's not that it gave me authority. It's that it gave me visibility. Around a message that I was very passionate about. So, and I know some people see it as that, and I use it in my bio, 2-time TEDx speaker, bestselling author, cause it's like, ooh, okay. I get it, but I want people to know that I actually care, real talk, way more about the impact, which is why I think my talk has a million views plus and counting, is because I cared about the impact and work versus the notch in the belt. And the visibility, yes, it did move my business, my life forward, grew my social media following on all accounts, grew my email subscribers, grew my podcast listeners, grew my supporters, got clients, got speaking engagements from it. All that stuff came out of that talk. But it if you go and you look at the comments long enough, I mean, you can't help but have your heart touched that this talk is making this impact in people's lives. And whatever you see on that comments, it's even more fulfilling and satisfying what I get in the DMs, because people are more transparent, more vulnerable with me. I get messages every day. I mean, right as of now, there's 1,500 people every day that watch the talk. And so I get messages every day, one or two, of somebody who's just like, this is exactly what I need to hear at the right moment. Thank you so much. I mean, people you would have never guessed of. I'm talking about a seven-figure entrepreneur in Moscow. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, so all of that came because I won a speaking competition. And then from there, I was doing an interview on for a TEDx event that they were doing, like a promotion material for their upcoming TEDx event. And they were interviewing influencers to get more visibility around their event. And I was one of those influencers they were interviewing. And I did a good job in their eyes. And so they then invited me to be a part of this year's speaking lineup. And I was like, it was virtual. So I was like, yeah, sure. You know, and I actually have probably 7 or 8 TED ideas. And so I pulled one out of the archive for them. And that's how I did my second talk.
So now how do, you know, a lot of people think, you know, cause I'm a speaker. I've spoken a lot on a lot of stages. And I unfortunately spoke in a lot of places where you know a lot of people won't go speak, prisons, rehabs, and
me a too, lot of, by the way,
you know, so, and usually, you know, if you're a speaker and you go into a rehab or a prison, if you're full of BS, they're going to call you out
in every day,
you know. So you have to be real when you talk from the stage. So talk to us about that and how to connect with an audience. Talk to us about that. I think that's very important. Is, you know, a lot of, they say that If you go see somebody speak, you may not remember the words that they said, but you'll always remember how you made them feel. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes. So everybody needs to go watch Chris Anderson's, the CEO of TED's video about what makes an idea or what makes a good TED talk. There's tons of science and other videos I would relate, but that's I love the way he shared it because it's easy and concise, but there is a lot of science around storytelling. Storytelling has been around for all of human existence. It's how we pass down our traditions. It's how we create our culture. It's all a narrative that we tell ourselves. You know, even the languages that we speak and the rules that we follow, both spoken and unspoken, are all a story that we tell ourselves. And so when you are giving a presentation, one of the ways that you connect with an audience is through telling compelling stories. And it's not about being animated. It's about articulating the idea in a way that connects the brain, you know, whatever you call them, waves to each other in the same pattern that yours is. And so, you know, Chris explains it so beautifully, but the science will show that when a person is telling story, that's the parts of the brain that the storyteller is using to tell the story syncs and will mirror in the same wavelength that the listeners are. And so that's what TED is about, is planting that idea, that shape that's in your mind of that idea, and planting in other people's mind, helping them to connect those dots to see it from your perspective. And that's why it's so powerful. And so you have to know that that is what you're doing when you're getting up there and speaking, and you're not entertaining. You're not trying to overload them with all the information that you know in the world. You're not even necessarily trying to inspire them. You're trying to implant an idea. And that's so different, because if I were telling you that you were going in the kitchen to bake a cookie versus you were going in the kitchen to bake a cake, that would change the items you would grab. And so I tell people, if you want to connect with an audience, start thinking of it that way. And that's what you're looking. And you start to think like, okay, now I'm trying to explain this idea to them versus me trying to like force feed or spoon feed them this information. And your intent when you speak matters. And the fact that you understand how story works helps you to better connect with the audience. That's what I will say. The other part that I will say is there's actually 7 dimensions of a speaker that we teach. And, you know, clients and stuff like that, And one of the most important ones where a lot of people fail is their body language. Their body language. A lot of times, because we're so focused on how people are perceiving us, we're forgetting the messages that we're sending with our body. Our body. And so learning how to use hand motions, the full length of your body, the uniqueness of your body to emphasize and anchor in those ideas in your talks helps you to connect with your audience in a way that you never would think is even possible.
I love that. So last couple of questions that I have, and I want you to enjoy the rest of your day, because I get the privilege of going to pick up my daughter from school. So I'm truly blessed. How do we find you? How can we find your TED Talks? How can we, if we want to, have you coach us up for speaking?
Yeah.
Or if we can just support your mission, how do we find you?
Yeah, thank you, man. I so appreciate that. You can go to DarylStenson.com. All of my information to connect with me is there. My coaching programs are there. My contact form is there. There's a link to all of my online courses, and there's a link to my apparel to support the mission. There's a link to my nonprofit organization, Second Chance Athletes, and it's all there in the website. So just go to DarylStenson.com. And you can also email me, Daryl@DarylStenson.com. If there's a way that I can add value, if my story can be beneficial to your community, if you want anything other than counseling, I'm not a counselor. I'm a coach. And so if you want coaching, I can help you specifically around speaking. But there's a few people who hire me to help them navigate their life and build their life. Just reach out, start a conversation. You know, I'm of the persuasion that if it's meant to be, it's meant to be, you know, and I don't force sales down people's throat, and they're always surprised when I'm so non-pressure. I just have a conversation, and if it makes sense and you see value in our coaching relationship, we'll just move forward. And I think that you hold people loosely that way, and life is so much easier for people. And so that's what I would say, is reach out to me there. My TED Talks are on the YouTube channel. So you can just YouTube my name and TEDx Talks. And there's also a ton of podcast videos and stuff out there. I've been on television twice and done a lot of podcast or radio interviews as well. So whatever you find out there, you know, if it sounds like this, it's probably me.
I love it. So now, last question, you know, we live in a crazy world right now. We live in a COVID world here in New Jersey. A lot of parents lost their jobs, so a lot of parents are driving Uber, DoorDash, just to make a living. So if I ask the average person in America to do something in 7 days, they're never going to get to it. But if I ask them to take an actionable step in the next 24 hours, they're most likely. So I'm going to ask you a two-pronged question. One, if somebody is struggling in their business, what can they do in the next 24 hours? Actually, I'm going to ask you a three-pronged question.
Okay.
Sorry. Second, if somebody's struggling with their mental health, what can they do in the next 24 hours? And yep. Third of all, and I think the most important thing of all, if somebody is struggling with their faith, what can they do in the next 24 hours? I know that's a lot to ask, but, you know, those are just the things I think people can actually use, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So the business and mental health, I can answer with the same answer. Business and mental health, you don't have to wait to tonight to do this. You can set a 15-minute timer right now, just start. Set a 15-minute timer and pull out a blank sheet of paper or pull out a Evernote file. Okay. And ask yourself, where's the tension in my life right now? If it's in my business, where's the tension? Like, what's really bothering me? Where am I really stuck? Okay. In mental health, who really hurt me? Like, follow the tension. That's all you got to do. Look for the tension. And you can probably look at earlier today if there was any. Some people already had it. And you look at that and you ask yourself, what is that showing me about me? How is this tension in my life making me better? What could I do to overcome this tension? A lot of times when we have problems in business and our mental health, it's because we see the problem as bigger than us. My depression is bigger than me. I can't take it. It's overwhelming me. My business is bigger than me. I can't take it. It's overwhelming me. My problems in my business are bigger than me. It's overwhelming. I can't take it. And there's something about slowing down and recognizing your power over the problem. And so that's what happens when you sit down, you look for the tension, and you start to pull answers from within yourself and God, and your situation gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Now you know, oh man, I should probably develop a routine in my mental health. I should probably eat better. Oh, I should probably get some funny videos to watch to pull myself out when I don't want to feel this low. I should probably go see a counselor. You'll come up with your best answers because nobody knows you better than God, and nobody knows you better than you. So that will fix both business and mental health problems, right? That's something they can do right now and today.
Okay.
On the faith side, it's almost the same thing, but it's funny how many answers come out of solitude and stillness. But I would tell you, you don't need a timer for this one. You just need to pause right now. You just need to ask God to show you whatever you need him to show you, to show up in whatever way you need him to show up, to give you clarity wherever you feel like there's confusion. You just ask. Yes, if you don't want to call him God, call him Father. If you don't want to call him Father, just say, hey, you up there. Just say you in there. If you whatever your belief is, just call out to something greater than yourself and ask for guidance and expect to either hear an answer or see an answer throughout your day today.
I love it, brother. I love it. Darrell, thank you so much for hopping on today. I know we've been talking about going back and forth for a while, and I'm so grateful that you took the time. And I think this is actually going to help change some people's lives. Because, you know, like you said, sometimes you said on a prior podcast that sometimes, you know, somebody will be inspired, but they don't take action after listening. And I think that this episode with you, there somebody out there is going to take action and change their lives. So I just want to say thank you so much for hanging out today. And thank you most of all for being a brother in Christ. So guys, definitely check him out. Definitely go to www.darrellstinson.com. Definitely check him out. He's got a lot going on. Check out some of his podcast episodes. They're all amazing. I think I've watched them all. So I just want to say thank you, my friend, and keep on doing God's work.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's such an honor to be on today. And you take care.
All right, brother. God bless you and the family.
Love you, man.
Love you, too.
Peace.
Hey, guys. If you're enjoying our show, if you love what we're doing, if you would like to support us, we have a whole bunch of great stuff coming out. We have a brand new t-shirt line that's coming out. Hats, coffee mugs, any kind of swag that lets your friends know that you support Vertical Momentum and you're always looking to get better. Also, we have our new coffee brand coming out. It's called Vertical Momentum Coffee. It's ass-kicking coffee. And it will get you moving in the morning. So guys, if you're interested, go to www.richardkaufman.net. Check us out. Leave us a note. Tell us what you'd like, and we'll actually send it to you. The new website is being built. So if you guys want to, our book is out there on Amazon. It's called A Hero's Journey from Darkness to Light. Definitely check it out. It talks about my story, but it also talks about how to survive depression, how to survive addiction. All right, guys, I love you. Thank you so much for always supporting our mission, which is to save lives.
Success stories and interviews with game changers and thought leaders who have overcome both in life and in business. Welcome to Vertical Momentum. Thank you for joining us today. Please hit subscribe and share. Please feel free to leave us a comment.